Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With the rise of stress in the modern world, a good night's sleep is going extinct. But there is hope. IKEA has everything you need to create a sleep sanctuary, like mattresses that make the perfect nest, bedding that matches your style, and curtains to keep that pesky sunlight from waking you. Check out ikea-usa.com/bedroom to discover new ways to save your sleep today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Friday, the 13th of September, these are our main stories. A coalition of groups committed to stopping deforestation has said an area of forest the size of 30 football pitches is lost every minute. The US Congress has granted itself broader powers to investigate President Trump. And while the body of Robert Mugabe has been lying in state, his family are battling the Zimbabwe government over burial plans. Also in this podcast, young men in Colombia are taking on a dangerous new pastime, cycling down steep mountain roads at incredible speeds.
The fastest I've been, it's 125 kilometers per hour in this highway.
Aren't you scared?
No.
And as Tunisians prepare to elect a new president, the leading candidate remains in prison and on a hunger strike. The battle to save forests around the world is being lost. That's the stark warning from experts who are looking into deforestation. A coalition of 25 organisations say the problem is accelerating at an alarming rate. The wildfires are still raging across the Amazon, Indonesia and parts of Africa, and they're making the situation even worse. Our environment analyst Roger Harabin reports.
In 2014, the Declaration on Forests was signed by more than 50 governments, more than 50 of the world's biggest forest firms, and many civil society organisations. A report from those organisations says that the initiative is failing. The signatories said they would strive to halve deforestation by 2020 and end it by 2030. But the report says the amount of primary tropical forest lost actually grew by almost 44% since the declaration. The authors say globally, annual carbon emissions from tropical forests equal the total greenhouse gas emissions of the European Union. The report says none of the 350 major firms exploiting forests is on track to meet its commitments to protect tree cover. Scientists agree the cheapest way of protecting the climate is to save existing forests. But the report says that cash spent on stopping tropical deforestation is less than 1.5% of the amount committed to tackling carbon emissions overall. Part of the problem is that several key forest nations didn't sign up to the pact. The forest nations also want huge annual compensation from rich countries for keeping forests that benefit the world. Then there's the ever-rising global demand for soya and beef, which is driving so much of forest destruction.
That was Roger Harabin. In the US, Donald Trump's political opponents continue to explore the possibility of impeaching him, a process that could lead to Mr. Trump being pushed from power. It's a divisive issue, even within the Democratic Party. But on Thursday, the Judiciary Committee in the US Congress voted to broaden its powers to investigate the president. The chairman of that committee, Jerry Nadler, was clear about their aims.
What we are doing is carrying on an investigation determine whether to recommend articles of impeachment against the president. With these new procedures, we will begin an aggressive series of hearings investigating allegations of corruption, obstruction, and abuse of power.
Well, our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told my colleague Chloe Tilley what this latest move means for the prospect of impeachment.
The Judiciary Committee, which is in a sense the committee in the House of Representatives that has the sort of role of conducting impeachment inquiries and preparing articles of impeachment, that has started to organise a little bit more in terms of giving powers to its staffers to investigate and to ask questions of witnesses, to gather documents in particular. And there would need to be more votes before a sort of formal impeachment hearing went ahead, and they, you know, potentially recommended that to the floor of the House of Representatives. But it is a step in that direction, and I think a sign, if you like, of the pressure that's built up inside the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives, where, you know, significantly more than half of their numbers now want this to happen.
If we look at the political structure, if you like, the different views on this, how likely are we to see this moving forward, or is this more the Democrats just trying to tap and chip away?
Well, I mean, bear in mind, impeachment is very, very difficult to do, because you have to not get it through the House of Representatives, but then there's what's called a trial in the Senate. Impeachment is another word for being charged. It's not another way of saying convicted. To be impeached is to be charged. And that ends up as a trial in the Senate. In order to be convicted in that trial in the Senate, you have to have a two-thirds majority. And of course, the Republicans control the Senate, and that's not going to happen. So the question for the Democrats is the process of all the hearings and going through it and the pressure that puts on the White House, is that politically worth it? And at the moment, the leadership in the Democrats, in the House in particular, don't think that's politically worth it, and that's why they're resisting pressures from the left of their party, the progressive wing, if you like, of their party, to push on with this. They think it could backfire and in a sense allow the president to be presented as someone who's been effectively victimised by Democrats on Capitol Hill.
That was Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. In what many have said is a surprising move, Twitter has blocked the accounts of the Cuban Communist Party leader, Raul Castro, his daughter, Mariela Castro, and Cuba's top state-run media outlets. Our correspondent in Havana, Will Grant, told me it's still not clear why the social media giant took this drastic step.
It is very, very odd in the sense that it began just before President Díaz-Canel gave details of what looked like would be another fuel shortage in Cuba by going on state television, a very well-known roundtable program called Mesa Redonda. Shortly before that, there was a few sort of what we assumed were anomalies going on with a few Cuban government accounts. Didn't really think too much of it. It continued after the program, and then there's been a series more today. And as you say, they include Raul Castro, his daughter, state-run newspaper Granma, or rather its account on Twitter, obviously not the actual web page of the state-run newspaper, and also the Twitter account of the state-run radio. So there, you know, a variety of what the Cuban government would consider important voices.
And what reaction has there been, not just from Cuban officials, but, you know, normal people in Cuba?
Sure. I mean, Cuban officials obviously are furious. They're saying, where is the explanation from Twitter? Any approach to Twitter has sort of so far just elicited a very standard response that accounts are closed for overlaps, for repetition, for this, that and the other. You know, they're standard reasons for which accounts are shut down. No specifics on why they would do this at this time against ones associated with the Cuban government. And what surprised me is that a lot of people on Twitter who are normally critical of the Cuban government are saying, look, we can't criticise the Cuban government for clamping down on free speech and criticise them there and then applaud the idea that this something is taking or shutting down or silencing their site. So quite surprising to see quite a few Cubans coming out in defence of the Cuban government, if you like, or certainly against the idea of closing down their accounts among people who would normally be very, very critical of the Cuban government's censorship.
That was Will Grant. Even in death, Robert Mugabe is proving to be a divisive figure in Zimbabwe. The former president, who died last week at the age of 95, was known both as a hero of independence and an iron-fisted tyrant. Now, a row has broken out between his family and the military men who ousted him from power over where he should be buried. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports from the capital city of Harare, where Mr. Mugabe is lying in state.
A rapturous reception this afternoon here in Harare as Robert Mugabe's body was brought by helicopter to a city stadium. His critics may grumble that today's crowd was bussed in, that these were loyal party supporters. But the mood here felt genuine, respect tinged with the knowledge that Mugabe had not been a perfect president.
He's my icon, he's my father, he's my everything. Mugabe was a good president, but you know, in power, everything happened.
As a politician, sometimes you can go wrong. We blame on that, but we cannot forget him because he fought hard. Zimbabwe was a colony. We were under British rule.
Zimbabwe's national anthem played as selected groups slowly began to file past his open coffin. It was a largely dignified occasion. But behind the scenes, the funeral arrangements for Mr. Mugabe are causing headaches, to put it mildly. His family say he wanted to be buried at his home village in the countryside. But today, a government minister, Paul Mavima, insisted the state would have the final say and that Mr. Mugabe should be buried in a cemetery for liberation heroes.
The appeal is just to say to the family, he is no longer yours. He is a national figure. He is an African icon.
It is an awkward tug of war, a reminder of the furious power struggles that led to 2017's military coup. Zimbabwe's current leadership may be keen to paper over those divisions now, but the Mugabe family, once almighty in this country, insist they won't be coerced.
That was Andrew Harding. Tunisia's presidential vote is due to take place this weekend, but one of the leading candidates is behind bars. The media magnate Nabil Karoui has been accused by authorities in the North African country of money laundering and tax evasion. Now, on the eve of the election, he's begun a hunger strike. I asked our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher, what led to this act of protest.
He has said that he is fighting for the right just to vote on Sunday, which is when the first round of the election takes place. I mean, Mr. Karoui was arrested 3 weeks ago. From his perspective, that's very fishy. I mean, he is the front runner in the elections. He has a big lead over the next candidate. There's 26 people standing, but he definitely led the field. Now, there was a law that was about to come into effect that would have ruled out a businessman with his extensive interest in any case. That didn't get passed because the previous president, Sebsi, died before he could put that into legislation, and it hasn't been approved since. So, I mean, his people, his party is essentially saying that the powers that be, the Prime Minister in particular, Yusuf Shahed, who used to be a close ally, is trying to stop him winning the election.
So you're saying that it was a very successful campaign, but obviously now there's absolutely no chance of him being voted in because he's in prison?
Well, no, that's not the case, actually. I mean, the fact is he's still allowed to stand. There isn't any reason given for the charges don't specifically say that he can't stand as president. So he's being allowed to stand as president. So he could be a situation in Tunisia, which until now has been, and this is why we're talking about it really, the beacon of some kind of stability in the Middle East after the Arab uprisings of 2011. It could be in a situation where its president is actually in prison and facing very serious charges of tax evasion and money laundering. So it could be heading for a crisis that really, it's pretty unexpected. His campaign, such as it is, I mean, this election was called very quickly after President Sebsi died. It was meant to take place in a couple of months from now. So there hasn't been much time for a campaign. But in essence, he's been campaigning for years. His television channel has a daily segment where he's seen spreading charity around the country, particularly in those poor areas that have not only not gained anything since the uprising, but have actually lost even more. Inflation has risen, unemployment has risen. So he's placed himself as a populist whose heart is in the right place as far as they're concerned. That's where his support is coming from. And in that perspective, his campaign has been a continual process.
That was Sebastian Usher. Still to come on this podcast, a Saudi princess has been convicted in the kidnap and beating of a plumber in Paris. And the colourful US oil tycoon T. Boone Pickens has died.
I had gotten to the highest I'd ever been. I got to $5 billion. I lost two, gave away $1 billion, and I've got one left. But it'll take me to the finish line.
The trend for fast fashion, buying cheap clothes and throwing them away after wearing them a few times, has been waning lately as consumers and even brands focus on more environmentally friendly options. Now, this sustainable approach has reached one of the biggest manufacturing markets in the world, China. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, told me why. Well, this is the big talking point in China today because China's official statistics bureau said that there's been a huge plummet between 2017 and 2018 with people in terms of the volume of clothes that they're buying. They've gone from buying 71.9 billion items all the way down to 54 billion, and that's a plummet of 24%. So it's a huge drop. And there are a number of reasons for this. One of them that's being discussed is because nowadays people are they're using rental services instead. So they're renting items rather than buying them. But one of the big talking points as well online is because people nowadays are recognizing that clothes are becoming more expensive and they'd rather buy decent quality clothes rather than have fast fashions.
And we know that the fashion industry is a major pollutant. Is the environment a factor in it as well?
People are becoming more environmentally friendly or more conscious about the way that they basically recycle goods. So one of the things that's been a big talking point in recent months is how cities like Shanghai, for example, have been making it a mandatory requirement that people divide their waste into the right rubbish or they could face fines. So now people, not just with clothes, but with food as well and all of their household waste, they're starting to think critically, if I'm buying lots of goods, they have to go in the right bin. Otherwise, I could face a huge fine or I could have my social credit impacted. And your social credit, which is a big system in China, this means that people could be denied opportunities to get a decent job or to go to a decent school, for example. So they're really starting to think about what they buy a lot more and if they've after they've used something, where it goes.
That was Kerry Allen. A Saudi princess has been convicted in her absence for her involvement in the kidnapping and beating of a plumber at her home in Paris. Princess Hassa bint Salman, the daughter of the King of Saudi Arabia, was given a 10-month suspended sentence and fined €10,000. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield was in court in Paris.
The plumber claimed that in September 2016 he was taking photographs with his mobile telephone of a bathroom in the princess's house on Avenue Foch. He said he needed to do this to remember how to put things back in order, but the princess accused him of trying to sneak pictures of her and her home in order to sell them. The plumber says he was then beaten and humiliated by the princess's bodyguard under her instructions. Hassa bint Salman, who's 42, left France shortly after the event and did not return for the trial, which took place 2 months ago.
Hugh Schofield. That's the Nigerian musician Nasiru Ahmed. He's one of the most popular artists in Kano State, but he's just been arrested. He's a supporter of Kano's emir, an influential traditional leader. In fact, he's literally singing the emir's praises in that song we've just heard. But the emir is locked in a political dispute with the state governor, and our Africa editor Mary Harper told me this arrest seems to be part of a wider political game.
This musician has been charged with releasing two songs illegally 4 years ago and also setting up a studio in his own house. So that's the official reason why he's been arrested. But many people in Kano and elsewhere in Nigeria are saying that this is very political. Number one, that this musician has released songs which question the authority of the governor of Kano, who's a controversial figure. One song actually asked the president, Muhammadu Buhari, to intervene in some questionable elections, some state elections. And also, there's a big fight going on between the governor of Kano and the emir. The emir is very cross with the governor because fairly recently he divided the emirate, which is this incredibly powerful area in Nigeria, in Kano. He divided it into five separate regions and only let the emir be in charge of just one of those regions. So the emir feels that his authority, which is traditional, that has been going on for centuries, is somehow under threat. And so some people are seeing this harassment and arrest of this musician as being in some ways something that's actually targeting the emir rather than the musician himself.
And this isn't the first time that the governor has fallen out with the creative community, is it?
No, there's been really a wave of arrests, not just of musicians, but of film directors and other artists in northern Nigeria, in Kano State in particular, who have have had a bit of a dig at the governor. They've been accused of defaming him in their work in their songs and other artistic work. And so basically it seems that there has been this kind of clampdown on artists in Kano State, and it is being seen as political, and people are very worried because the music and creative industry in that state and in northern Nigeria is really vibrant and very much alive, and they're saying this is a complete threat to art, to culture, to freedom of speech.
That was Mary Harper. It's called gravity biking. Cyclists rocketing down steep mountain roads at almost unthinkable speeds. And it's become a popular pastime for young men in Medellin, in the South American country of Colombia. But the stakes are high. 10 young men have been killed while gravity biking in the past year and a half. The BBC's Simon Mabin's been to Medellin to find out what's being done to stop more deaths.
Estos niños primero suben pegados de los vehículos.
We're with the police, and Viviana was just talking about the young guys hooked onto the back of trucks, and immediately we've seen one. He's just let go of the truck and crossed the road, and now he's heading back down the other way.
That's the reaction they have when they see the police, because they know that we take the bikes. They don't even think about the danger. They immediately cross to the other carriageway without looking to see if there's any traffic coming.
So, what makes gravity bikes special? On a bridge in the northwestern outskirts of the city, I meet a group of bikers. 16-year-old Marlon shows me round his homemade bike, which is so low to the ground it only comes up to my knee. One of the most striking things about this bike is there are four different weights attached to it. And how fast do you think you go on this?
The fastest I've been, it's 125 kilometers per hour in this highway.
Aren't you scared?
No.
Maybe he should be. Two of Marlon's friends have died this year, and he's had a near-fatal accident. Until recently, Andres Felipe Gutierrez worked with gravity bikers at the City Sports Institute, INDA. While the city has made some effort to support the bikers, he says it's not been enough.
Unfortunately, we are affected by the culture of no future in our city. That was one of the biggest impacts of the drug trafficking of the 80s and 90s, that the young men of Medellin live in the today, because tomorrow doesn't exist.
The police have been running campaigns to try to encourage the bikers into other activities, but Marlon says the police knock them off their bikes and assault them, something the police deny. There's nothing illegal per se about modifying your bike and riding it down a steep road, except in the small town of La Ceja, south of Medellin.
Fui el primer alcalde de Colombia, diría yo.
I was the first mayor in Colombia, I would say, to introduce a law banning the circulation of this type of bike in my territory. We are seeing less accidents. We haven't had such news about young people from La Ceja lately.
Back in Medellin, Marlon says gravity biking is his passion. Despite the death of his friends and his own accident, he has no plans to stop.
I want to spend my life just crying over what happened. I just have to keep on moving.
Simon Mabin in Colombia. And you can hear more of that report on the podcast Assignment from the BBC World Service. For decades, he was one of the richest men in America, called the Oracle of Oil. T. Boone Pickens, a US energy tycoon, has died at the age of 91. His first oil and gas firm, founded in the 1950s, became one of the world's largest independent oil companies. By the early 2000s, he was a billionaire. The BBC's Rod Sharp interviewed him back in 2014 and asked Mr. Pickens how he'd describe himself.
I'm CEO of BP Capital. I'm a geologist, and I'm involved in a few financial deals.
One or two here and there. Can you tell me how I understand Texas? Because every time I tell somebody, I think I've got it, they say, no, 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 you haven't got Texas at all. You don't understand. For an outsider, what is it that makes Texas, Texas?
Very simple. We've got more resources than any state in the United States. When you look at the success of states here, how they're run, how they're managed, Texas is number one. It all comes down to leadership.
There was a great fuss made last year when Forbes magazine took you off the billionaires rich list, and they said your fortune had slipped to 950 million or something. Did that bother you one way or another?
No, I've slipped before. This time I had gotten to the highest I'd ever been. I got to $5 billion.
Oh.
I lost two, gave away $1 billion, and I don't know what happened to $1 billion, and I've got one left. It's kind of where I am, but it'll take me to the finish line.
You know, some people would go to the beach with $1 billion, wouldn't they?
I don't like the beach. I always get sunburned.
The American energy tycoon T. Boone Pickens, who's died at the age of 91. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.